apologize for starting this late. The meeting was supposed to start at 10. Other members had some commitments, hence we had to start late. Last week, before we adjourned, we requested the parliamentary legal advisor to go through the negotiating mandates, compile them, and come and brief the committee. And without any waste of time, I'll hand over to her to brief the committee. Menge.
Greetings to everybody, and thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, please allow me to explain first the process that we went through in attempting to finalize the task that we were given. We met together with the state law advisor, and we went through together with our content advisor on the mandate and prepared the document that has been distributed to the members. We will be talking through that document and indicating as well the legal content and legal issues that the content have raised. So where it is necessary, Chairperson, my colleague from the state law advisor would also come in and speak to certain issues, but I will take through the presentation, the one that was collated, which reads consolidated negotiating mandates of the traditional court. What we attempted to do with that document was to collate all issues or amendments proposed in relation to each clause from each province. So that's basically the structure of the document. I will read through first what clause 1, which deals with the definition as to what was proposed. The Limpopo province proposed that the enhance, which we find in the preamble, should be changed to promote. And that means the bill should read at the preamble where it says the other purpose or intention of the bill is to enhance customary law and customs of communities observing a system of customary law. So instead of using enhance, Limpopo was suggesting that we use promote. The other definition is that definition of a traditional court, Inkantolo yendabuko, Inkundla yomdabu, isiZulu. So instead of using Inkantolo yendabuko, the KZN province requested or suggested that it should change to Inkundla yomdabu. And the other province, Limpopo, also indicated that there is no definition for family court, and we should replace traditional leader wherever it appears with Hoshi, and senior traditional leader with Hoshi.
Hoshi Hulu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Definition of traditional leadership and governance framework act must also include a word as amended. That also comes from the Limpopo. The bill makes no mention of chief court. So now, in response, I will take through all these concerns as they have been indicated. I found that it is crucial to explain what the word enhance means as opposed to the word promote. The English dictionary that I checked defines enhance as to intensify or increase in value or increase in power or improve or augment, whilst promote actually means to further or to encourage the process, the progress or existence. And in terms of that, I think it will be the decision of the committee to consider whether what should be the case. We leave enhance or we go with promote. Again, the question that speaks to the definitions of all the hierarchy of traditional courts.
Just a moment, ma'am.
Chair, the paper that you're still reading now, I don't have that paper.
Well, it's the same document that we had.
No, Chair. No? No, I'm not disrupting. I just want
to... No, not you. Elsa?
Chairperson?
What Honorable Gundar is trying to say is that we do have a document, just like last week, pointing out the proposals. But the legal opinion that we asked for, we are only getting verbally now. And we have asked for a written document. I think that is what Honorable Gundar refers to. I would like to, point number two, ask you if we are going to, for instance, on line three and the word enhanced, to use as an example, are we going to debate that point now, or are we going to do it at the end of the definition?
Yes, ma'am. Allow the legal advisor to present, and then we'll engage with the document after she has presented.
At the end?
Yes. Can you continue, ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. As I said, I was going to go through clause as appears in the bill and then speak to the legal issues that the provinces have raised. And whilst on that, I was then going to give definitions of the points or definitions that have been raised as I pointed out. For instance, the Traditional Legal Framework Governance Framework Act provides that a traditional leader means any person in terms of customary law of a traditional community who holds a traditional leadership position and is recognized in terms of the provisions of that act. That act further specifies that a senior traditional leader means a traditional leader for a specific traditional community who exercises control over headmen or headwomen in accordance with the customary law or within whose area of jurisdiction a number of headmen or headwomen exercises authority. Basically, the senior traditional leader definition means it's making references to either the kings or the queens and the regents, the main authority that is in position over the other structures within the customary structure. And I also thought it's crucial to define, as the Act does, the traditional council, which defines it as a council recognized or established by the premier of each province in terms of Section 3 of the Traditional Legal Governance Framework Act in a recognized traditional community. Traditional councils can also have sub-councils according to the Act. Now, from this definition, it is very clear that a traditional council or headman or headwoman cannot exist without the recognition of a senior traditional leader or existence of a senior traditional leader in such a recognized community. Now, from the Act as well, the Traditional Legal Framework Act, it is clear that kings or queens can have their councils as well, which are called kingship or queenship councils. And the issue that I'm trying to define or speak to now are the issues that speak to the hierarchy and definition of the court that the current bill that we are busy processing did not take into recognition and also does not give definitions, which has created, in my understanding and opinion, it's created the confusion and the issues that are raised in terms of the definitions, I believe they relate to that. And I also submit that perhaps if the bill is going to be refined or amendments will be proposed, the proposals that have been placed in relation to what the definitions of the Governance Framework Act are already indicating, such correlation must be made and considered so that they are both given effect. Because also this bill makes reference mostly to the definitions that come out from that Act. That covers the clause one on the definitions concerned, as alluded in that document before the members. Moving to clause two of the bill is the clause that provides object or the intention that this act, once it's enacted, it intends to achieve. And the collated concerns or issues raised read thus, the bill does not create uniformity and leave the process at the discretion of each traditional court to determine the content of the law. Procedures for traditional courts must be strictly regulated and certain rights must be guaranteed as it appears in the Constitution. And speaking legally to the concerns that have been raised, the bill, in actual fact, does leave procedure determination as to how the traditional courts will be conducted. Either, it says, in terms of the customary law that is practiced, alternatively, if we look at regulations in clause 21 of the bill, it does make some mention that the minister must determine regulations as to how the procedure of the court must be. However, I think for the procedure, because that's a question that's under clause 9, I will speak in detail under clause 9. The provinces, however, do prefer that there be a uniform regulation or regulatory framework that comes with the bill so that it ensures necessary consistency and uniformity throughout the system. However, if the enabling provision in terms of the procedure that enables the minister to make regulations is perhaps not sufficient, or the committee finds that it's not sufficient to cover the concerns that the provinces have raised, there are two possibilities. The procedures could be set out in the bill itself. Alternatively, if it will be left out as clause 21(2) of the bill provides, which enables the minister to make those regulations, the regulations thereof could, in this bill, make a provision that says once the minister has prepared and consolidated the provisions, the regulations, prior to promulgation or prior to publication, they should come to Parliament for Parliament to approve those regulations. And I think that covers clause 2 on the object. So legal uniformity could be covered as indicated through the two options that I've just presented, and it will be the decision of the committee as to which option we go forward with. Clause 3, which talks to the guiding principles, I think clause 2 and 3 are basically speaking to the same directive as to how the system should operate through traditional courts. And the concerns that were raised actually interrelated or overlapped between the two from what the provinces were indicating. And clause 4 seems to be the very contentious one, because most all provinces did mention something on clause 4, and in the manner that we have collated the document, we've tried to capture all the content, and the response will also speak to all the content in general. It says some of the content indicated that under clause 4, not some, all of them, there should be a competency assessment for traditional leaders as presiding officers. Designation should be revoked if failure to acquire such competency is not complied with. The bill must speak to when a presiding officer can be designated. It should not be left out to the regulation. The bill is silent on the Council of Elders, who should preside over traditional courts. The gender representation of presiding officers ought to be changed to give women greater representation. Furthermore, it seems the criteria that is being followed for presiding officers is based on birth rights of presiding officers, and others are excluded. There is no provision when presiding officers have a conflict of interest. Presiding officers must recuse themselves from dealing with such matters. Training programs should be extended to headmen, headwomen, members of traditional councils, and officials working for traditional courts. Training programs should only be the prerogative of the minister, but must involve traditional leaders since they are designed for them. The designation of persons as traditional leaders should not be limited to kings, queens, and senior traditional leaders, but should be extended to any persons that the minister may appoint. This could be any person who is regarded as being of good standing in the community, such as a priest or school principal. Induna or headmen or headwomen should also be designated as alternative presiding officers. Training should also be extended to officials appointed to serve in the traditional court. The traditional court bill allows for the minister to designate a senior traditional leader as the presiding officer of the traditional court in terms of 4-1. This provision will have a tendency to centralize power in the hands of traditional leaders. Such circumstances will allow for traditional leaders to enforce controversial versions of customary entitlements of women, as well as ordinary members of the traditional community. Finally, the 2 points, there should be role clarification between the chief and the headman. All traditional leaders should be properly briefed on section 10 of the bill, and they should also be provided with the constitution and properly workshops. Again, the responses to all the concerns under clause 4 have been legally compiled together, and I will speak to them as such. I will start with the issue of women participation or women representation as a concern throughout the bill. Maybe starting with the point that the department made on the previous meetings, that in fact they are of the opinion that the 40% threshold determined in terms of the Legal Framework Government Act could be the process that is followed or adopted in terms of the manner that this bill is couched. Alternatively, that could be redrafted in to give effect to that 40%. From clause 9-2, if we read clause 9-2, that clause makes it the responsibility of the presiding officer to ensure full and equal participation of women. However, I believe if one looks at the concerns that the provinces have raised, it seems that clause is also insufficient to cover women participation as would be preferred. Furthermore, the Governance Framework Act provides a definition for area of jurisdiction as an area designated for a traditional community and a traditional council. If that definition of area of jurisdiction is taken into account, one can have cognizance of the fact that traditional councils are already now, or in terms of those measures from the Traditional Governance Framework Act, women are included. The women concern or women participation concern is covered in other traditional councils which have already given effect to these obligations and requirements. Furthermore, in terms of the bill process or the way that they've explained it, the court jurisdiction must be related to either the chieftaincy, that being the senior traditional leader, or the jurisdiction of the traditional court, the jurisdiction of the traditional council. And the constitution there, the constitution of the traditional council, as I say, some of the areas are already considering ensuring that there is full women participation. So I think there should be proper reference and effect given to the injunctions from the Governance Framework Act into this bill, which will give effect to those concerns. But then again, there are certain number of constitutional court cases that have spoken to the issues that were discriminatory practices against women. One in mind thinks of the Shulubana case and the Bear judgment, where the court were having concerns that women, for no apparent criteria or constitutional measures, are just ignored, even where there is no more a male heir that can take the position, there is no one. So in the Shulubana case, the court actually found that there should be recognition, even if the custom says it should only be male that takes the leadership position. The constitution demands that there should be equality amongst all, and persons should not be discriminated in terms of gender. And it was the same issue in the Bay case as well. It was dealing with the primogeniture principle, and there the court also said, in fact, effect for the full participation of both male and female within the customary system should be recognized and given effect. I think to further take this point about the women participation is the definition that the still exists, the Black Administration Act provides of the tribal settlement, because it also means, as it means, any area where persons residing according to indigenous law. So if one looks at those definitions, both of the tribal settlement area of jurisdiction and the constitution, or the manner in which the traditional councils in terms of the law are to be constituted, perhaps the women participation concern could be covered if there is proper reference from this bill that ensures that those provisions are given proper effect, or if in this bill such clear express terms are also indicated. But for now, the manner that the bill is cast, there is serious lack that ensures that such women, such concerns are actually taken and given credence to. Under clause 4.1, I think another concern that I thought is crucial, which the provinces have noted as well, Gauteng pointed out that clause 4.1 provides for the senior traditional leader to be the presiding officer. And furthermore, if you read that clause, it says the other structures like your head woman or head man can be presiding officers upon the request of the senior traditional leader, requesting the premier or the minister to give effect to that request. So it's not, as the provinces have pointed out, it's not a broad, open instance that if you are a headman, as the current structure are, because as I indicated earlier on, there are headman courts and there are other clan courts or family courts. I mean, the structure is broad, but the bill does not take cognizance of that. Hence, clause 4.1 is indeed problematic in a sense that it only leaves that to the hands of the senior traditional leader to make a request that the other structures can in fact function as presiding officers, whereas that then is contradictory to the structure as currently is in terms of the customary system. Furthermore, clause 4 makes a provision that recognition can be revoked if any of the presiding officers have failed to attend the training. And there were concerns on the assessment criteria as to what sort of persons can become presiding officers, and there is restriction as to who can get the training. If we look at Regulation 21.1a and B, the criteria on the presiding officer is that it should come out from the regulation. So in other words, clause 21.1a enables the minister to make regulations that will provide what is the criteria and what are the training programs and training-related issues that should be covered. One can never be certain then as to what the regulations eventually would cover, but from what is before the committee right now, and if it is insufficient to leave it broadly under the regulation delegated power, it is the prerogative of the committee to instruct and strengthen these provisions as the committee may deem fit. Another argument that was raised by one province was to the fact that even if the minister may make the program, there should be some form of consultation that happens with the National House of Traditional Leaders. In fact, my submission is that that is a plausible point. Consultation should perhaps be opened generally to all the provincial houses and traditional councils, other than just looking at the inclusion of the National House of Traditional Leaders. But again, that is a point of discussion and final instruction by the committee. They also mentioned that the training programs must speak to the must have a specific focus that speaks to the sanctions, which I think also, if the program of training is consulted with all those issues that have been raised, will be fleshed out, and the program might actually cover all the concerns that the traditional leadership faces in their daily basis, and they will have a proper input that can influence the final product. What I also noted is that it is not clear who will offer training. However, the bill makes provision that the department's director general would have registers or must keep registers that keep a record as to who is the presiding officer that has been trained and who is the presiding officer that has not been trained. So perhaps the bill also needs strengthening in terms of setting out a number of issues that are not clearly expressed in the bill. Another concern that was raised was that concerning the restricted offer of training. It seems to be restricted to senior traditional leaders only. The provinces are suggesting that, in fact, training should be broadened and open to all the traditional structure, to all the traditional leadership structures, including all the form of support or assistance that they get or they are utilizing in order to make sure that the system functions efficiently. So the training should not only be limited to the senior traditional leadership that has been declared or determined as presiding officers, but training throughout the system operators would be a good thing and beneficial to all. The last point which they spoke to in terms of the training and the appointment of presiding officers is that it's in the way the bill is carved. It seems to say that you become a presiding officer due to the birth right that you come from royal family, and that amongst other provinces was a concern. Which I believe the committee must look into that and consider strengthening or providing an amendment. I think also in relation to this concern was the issue of conflict of interest. The provinces pointed out that the issue of conflict of interest is not addressed in the bill, which is true. My submission to that would be, if the bill is refined or proposals are made, there should be an express provision that sets out the procedure as to how the refusal principle can be utilized in this process for the presiding officer who may be aware that there is a conflict of interest, or if there is a request made that I think you will have an interest on this matter, then there should be a procedure as to how the presiding officer can recuse themselves and how, if the recusal takes place, what is the alternative process that should kick in. I think also I must submit that should the presiding officer's position be extended beyond only the senior traditional leadership, as most provinces have actually favored that principle, that will take into account the actual existing structures within the customary system. They also propose that the roles between the chiefs, the headmen, and all the other structures must be clarified in line with the hierarchy of existing structures. My submission is that there is also a plausible concern which must be given effect through amendments. I will move to clause 5, which I think it would be safer to address clause 5 and 6. And in response, clause 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 all together, because there are some overlapping concerns that were raised. But I'll first look at clause 5, which deals with the jurisdiction for civil matters. The concern in brief indicated that it is proposed that there must be more exclusion on the civil jurisdiction of the traditional courts, and they must not hear cases such as those relating to paternity disputes, claims of maintenance, issues relating to marriage, domestic violence, amongst the many that they mentioned. The process to determine paternity is more sophisticated, and the traditional leaders do not have access to that. Under clause 5.12b, the other concern noted that it is incorrect to reiterate that traditional courts cannot get involved in matters of divorce or separation. The opinion is that from that specific province, the opinion is that the families should get involved when challenges arise in marriage disputes as per tradition. The bill was not further explicit on the participation of women, that it was also not clear on where the city of the traditional council or traditional court would be. Jurisdiction of civil disputes on customary law should not be limited to where the act or omission has occurred, but should also be extended to the consent of the parties, with an option to refer the matter to any desirable court that the parties may wish. Clause 5.2 highlights on matters that the traditional courts may not deal with, which includes, amongst others, divorce or separation arising out of a customary marriage under the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act. The civil matters in terms of customary law that may be dealt with must at least be outlined in the bill or regulation to be proposed in order to guide parties on what kind of matters can be referred to traditional courts. And coming to the criminal jurisdiction now, the settlement of criminal disputes. The bill must make it an offense for traditional courts to hear matters outside those mentioned in the schedule. The traditional courts operate outside the provision of the Criminal Procedure Act and Section 35(3) of the Constitution. The bill must clearly specify different types of assaults and offences, such as witchcraft is contemplated in the schedule of the bill. The bill must be explicit and not create room for doubt, and it must be clearly stated that traditional courts cannot hear rape cases, for instance. It is proposed that a schedule explaining offences that do not form part of the jurisdiction of traditional courts must also be included in the bill, and not only jurisdiction that sets out what it is that they can try. The challenge was that traditional courts are not assisted by the magistrate courts. For example, when an offender refuses to appear before traditional courts, the traditional courts operate in the justice. The traditional court, I The traditional court operates in the justice sphere of government and is distinct from Section 166 of the Constitution. Persons should have the option for opting out of jurisdiction of the traditional court system. And then 7, which speaks to the nature of traditional courts. As I said, I will speak to all three, clause 5 and 6. The general consent there was that the traditional court operates in the justice sphere of government and is distinct from Section 166 of the Constitution. The combination of both executive and judicial functions on the part of traditional leaders is contrary to the principle of separation of powers. Traditional leaders are expected to uphold customary practices, represent communities, and act as a partial presiding officer. This may give rise to a conflict of interest as the independence of the traditional leader may be compromised. Power is centralized in the senior traditional leader and goes against the principle of separation of powers. Traditional courts must be mediation and arbitration bodies like the CCMA. Legal representation should be available to people who appear. I think this one. Let me speak to the legal principles or the law in relation to the issues that have been raised for clause 5, 6, and 8. And then perhaps clause 7, because it touches on constitutional principles. I will cover it, like your separation of powers. I will cover it at the end when looking at all the general concerns that have been raised. In terms of the proposals that have been made, my submission is that civil jurisdiction together with criminal jurisdiction should, in fact, be clarified or restricted further so that it is clear for the people that are going to implement the instructions of this Act. Currently, as noted by most provinces, there seem to be many blur lines, which will also be the same case for traditional authorities when they must give effect to the bill. As the exclusions must be expressly clear and explicit in that they've taken consideration of the existing legislation like your Domestic Violence Act, the Maintenance Act, the Family Court Act, together with the Criminal and Procedure Act and the Evidence Act. I think even if these structures would not be courts, but if they are given criminal jurisdiction, at least reference which should either guide the end result of the procedures of this court should perhaps be given effect and be considered for purposes of the procedures and how the traditional courts may function in terms of the regulatory framework that this bill seeks to provide. The issues raised in relation to clause 5, 6, and 10, which 10 speaks to the sanctions that each jurisdiction, either a criminal jurisdiction or a civil jurisdiction, is provided for, is what I'm addressing now. I think another province indicated that the bill must actually specify that it is an offense for a traditional court to go beyond the jurisdictional powers that it has been granted. That is an issue that your normal review processes, because it looks into the procedural flaws of the process or the trial. It's an issue for review. And perhaps moving forward to give effect to that concern, the bill must give a clear regulation or clear expression that matters handled by traditional courts are reviewable, and if they are, which court should review them as a right that is found in Section 35.30 of the Constitution, that if there's an adverse criminal decision made against a person, that person has a right to review or to appeal. It also gives effect to the content of the Section 33 rights as well as the PAJA, the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. I think within jurisdiction as well, criminal, another province raised that certain offences must be excluded or clarified. For instance, there was one that raised a concern about crimen injuria and the fees that will be determined. And the concern was that crimen injuria is a crime against dignity and reputation, and it's not easy to find that determination, which is confirmed by the definition as well of what is crimen injuria. And from looking at the previous act, like your Black Administration Act, which is still the act that is giving effect to this jurisdiction, to traditional court, the schedule there in the Black Administration Act, in fact, excluded crimen injuria from the jurisdiction of traditional court, just to give context to that concern. I believe that these provisions, as noted by the provinces, require extensive redrafting and amendments as well, and the comments are very substantial and legal in nature and must be given effect moving forward. Going back to clause 7, which I've already read the concerns that relate to it, I think legally speaking, the provision is not clear to say that traditional courts would be administrative structures, but it says they would be distinct from courts that are specified in Section 166. I think that is the main thing that raises the concern from the provinces, even if they provide suggestions, not knowing whether this is a court or it's something in between, as other provinces have indicated, like your CCMA, but the CCMA also has legal measures in place to guide their processes, which in terms of this bill, that is very much lacking, as has been argued. I think also giving effect to the operational structures as they exist right now, which I spoke earlier on to, like the different hierarchy of the traditional court. If the bill had given effect to that, most of the concerns would be addressed to that that are coming out from clauses like 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 9. For instance, the one that comes in mind was the province which raised the concern that what happens where a person from another clan or another jurisdiction has committed an offense in the jurisdiction of another chief, and they apply customary law that is different from where he has offended the community as opposed to where he comes from. The structure from practical purposes, I think, as they would have inter-clan courts and other structures would address such instances, because it allows the elders from different clans whom the accused person or the litigant that has a civil dispute, if it's two people coming from different places, the inter-clan court with elders from both tribes actually assist in terms of such problems. But the bill does not also consider that, except that I think it's clause 9 or clause 8 where it provides that in such instances, the presiding officer will have to impose his decision or her decision once they've decided that here is a matter before me and I'm proceeding with it. But if the person does not come from that jurisdictional area, the presiding officer will have the final say, which perhaps might be unconstitutional. Clause 8, a concern on Clause 8, which was dealing with discriminatory practices, I think more so as was based on women not being able to participate or exceed it, because Clause 8 is the one that speaks to the sessions of the traditional court. If effect is given to the department's proposal that, in fact, the definition for traditional courts must be refined to consider that traditional councils or other structures within the customary system must be given effect, amendments to Clause 8 would also be necessary. But it's a question of once when it's decided what exactly is the position or structure that the traditional courts would give effect to the necessary amendment to Section 8. Because the concern there was that presiding officer must be changed to traditional counsel and vice versa. I think, as I said, the answer there lies in the final decision once it's decided what a traditional court would be or what a traditional court would be defined to constitute. Then under Clause 9, I think it's the concerns that are on procedure, which I've also noted. I will just speak also in general because the concerns are also overlaid. I will start with the legal representation issue, which most provinces were saying prohibiting legal representation, it's treading on the constitutionality as well as violating actually the rights that are provided in Section 35. Section 35(3)(f) grants the right to legal representation to any accused person that must be criminally tried in a fair and open manner. The bill grants criminal jurisdiction to the traditional courts, however, deprives people the rights that Section 35(3)(f) provides. Now, taken to court, that would really be a constitutional matter that may find ground and for the court to decide in favor of. So already it seems unconstitutional that criminal jurisdiction would be granted whilst at the same time legal representation, understanding that generally and historically legal representation was not a matter of concern. But I suppose the problem now arises with the constitutional order, which is supreme, and we cannot really decide that because it's dealing with the customary law, which was previously dealt in this manner, then there are rights that should be that should be violated. I think it boils back to the same question about women representation, because if the Constitution gives the right to equality, whilst it gives the right to legal representation as well, how can then it be constitutional to limit certain rights to enable the system? I think that's a point that also need to be considered by the committee. And furthermore, I think it's crucial to note that it has been tried law and decided that an administrative body cannot really argue that Section 35(3)(f) right of legal representation, that can be limited in terms of the fact that it's an administrative body and not so much a court of law. But then, if it's an administrative body, Section 3, sub 3 of PAJA provides that where there are complex and serious matters, in fact, the administrator must consider assisting the person that whose rights would be adversely affected, that they must grant them the legal representation. This is also a constitutional argument, and it's a constitutional issue. And looking at those two provisions, PAJA and Section 35, it's a wishy-washy prohibition, and 9.3A is problematic against the background of those two legal provisions I've just mentioned. 9.3B also, they raise the concern that it should be omitted because it perpetuates disregard for the protection of women as well as women participation. I think that's also a valid point, because if it says representation may be limited in the manner that provision is phrased, it requires either, as the other provinces have suggested, that it be omitted or it be relooked at and another draft to cover that concern to come up. 9.4, they also pointed out that it does not enforce, or it fails to enforce, the principle that most concerns are raised, that people must be allowed to either opt out or opt in. But 9.4 grants the presiding officer, as I pointed out, the power to impose on the litigants that we will go through with this. Whether you understand that customary law is practiced in that certain tribal settlement or you don't. But if the presiding officer has made the decision that it must proceed, so it does proceed, despite the rights of the person that might be violated. It does not cater for people who would not understand the operations or know the customs or traditions of that specific custom, of that specific area he has transgressed. However, I think the task is so huge on the presiding officer, because it may require that the presiding officer somehow finds out or interrogates whether the person is vested with the certain custom or transgression, and the way that it's dealt with that he or she is accused to have done. So consequently, 9.4 may be problematic, and it does not provide details to guide the presiding officer as well as the persons that would have to have this applied, whether they wish to have it applied against them or not. 9.5 has financial implications and raises the issue which other provinces raised of unfunded and funded mandates, and as to how the traditional courts can give effect to what 9.5 is actually giving effect to. That covers clause 5, 6, 7, and 8, including 9. And I will proceed now to clause 10, consent, which deals with the sanctions. As I said earlier on, I've tried to cover all these four clauses together, but there are specific concerns that were raised in relation to clause 10. Reading them, they say that clause 9.5 is clear on what must happen to the fines that are imposed by the traditional courts, insofar as the fines are expressed in monetary terms. However, this clause is silent on the orders that are not expressed in monetary terms, like orders in the form of livestock, as in the case in clause 10.2b. This raises the question as to what happens to the livestock which may be imposed as a sanction. Does it become the property of the presiding officer? Excuse, the bill does not clarify that. Clause 10.2f is unclear how the court will hear criminal matters that will fall under the jurisdiction of the National Prosecuting Authority. Clause 10.2gh violates the dignity of a person, and it may be cruel, inhumane, degrading, and also promote slavery. From the research taken and understanding the concerns that are raised, it is true, in fact, that there have been some cases that have been brought to court in an attempt to show that other powers that the traditional authority leadership has can be excessively used at the expense of the rights that are entrenched in the Bill of Rights. And therefore, my argument or conclusion would be the appropriate order phrase in clause 10 is really vague and very broad to enable even sanctions that may be unconstitutional and, in my view, would require refinement. 10 to F, subclause 10 to F, which provides that in a criminal dispute, a traditional court may impose an order directing that the matter be submitted to the NPA for possible institution of criminal proceedings. May perhaps the regulations clarify further, but it also imposes a duty that there must be some relation that is effective and functional between the structures and what happens where other traditional authorities are finding the difficulty to get that assistance which this bill provides, that matters must be transferred or there must be some form of correlation between the structures. There was another proposal which indicated that there must be an addition to the sanctions to the effect that an offender can be decimated or banished from the area where he stays. I think that also, because it was suggesting that in terms of the, it must, the offender could be banished in relation to the interest of the community. I think the question one that would be concerned with is, what is the definition of interest of community? What would be the criteria, and who will determine that this is against the interest of the community and requires that the person be banished? But it's also unconstitutional, just as 10-2I is unconstitutional in that it says people may be deprived of their property, whereas Section 25 provides a procedure as to how appropriate deprivations could occur. Most sanctions are actually punitive, which is contrary to the intention of the bill and is most likely to be implemented unfairly and violate as many rights as possible. So amendments are necessary to make Clause 10 constitutional as well as lawful. The enforcement process from Clause 11, which basically, if we read the concerns raised, it says the traditional court must conduct an inquiry into a person's ability to comply with an order or prior to an order is made. This clause complies with the Constitution. People will have to travel far to the office of the sheriff to have orders of the court executed. The bill must provide for the traditional court leaders, must provide means for the traditional court leaders to force the offenders to pay their fines or to remove the offender from the community if they see fit. The bill must also provide for protection of the traditional leader that bill must take the principle of proportionality into account when issuing fines. I think the enforcement process that is envisaged by Clause 11 is actually misplaced, and instead the bill should have provided that it should happen prior to sentencing or the punishment that is given to the person, because the traditional court must inquire as to what that the person can be able to offer in order to address whatever conviction or punishment he has been given. In other words, if we follow the criminal and terms used in the criminal procedure, the court, before in fact giving sentence, should inquire into the mitigating and aggravating circumstances that will enable the court to know which direction to go and what preferred sanction, in terms of the sanctions that they are mandated to offer, they should give. Clause 11 requires an amendment, I believe. Clause 12, the concern raised is that the clause is limiting the right of appeal as well as the right to administrative action. This clause does not achieve its intended purpose because it does not lead to speedier or less formal and less expensive access to justice. I also believe that making the order of the traditional court final, especially on criminal cases, could be unconstitutional, considering that Section 3530 allows persons to appeal or review whatever it is that they are not satisfied with, which will impact on them. Clause 13 deals with appeals. Appeals should be allowed irrespective of the order of the sanction. The appeal structure should recognize the hierarchy in traditional authorities. Appeals should be chaired by a headman and must go to the chief and thereafter to the king. The limits on the right of appeal to one in respect of certain sanctions impacts on the right of access to court enshrined in Section 34. Magistrate courts are already overburdened, and they would require magistrates who will specialize in African customary law. The bill must allow for a traditional court of appeal to allow for appeals to be dealt within the customary tradition. There must be automatic review of cases when dealing with vulnerable groups. If appeals are handled by magistrates, offenders would undermine the authority of the traditional leaders. The appeals process should be strengthened to ensure that the traditional communities have legitimate processes through which to appeal against the decision of the traditional court. The concerns raised by the provinces most of which are valid. However, I think the limitation of the right to appeal, which is restricted to certain other sanctions, as the bill indicates, is also unfair and unconstitutional. I think Clause 13 and Clause 14, which both deal with reviews and appeals, procedural reviews and appeal proceedings, as the bill currently provides, is really in technical and legal terms.
I just wanted to request that we are supposed to get into another meeting now at half past 12. If the process can be fastened.
Now I have to finish the room. Continue, ma'am.
So the appeals and review processes do require reconsideration and amendments to take into account what the Constitution provides. Clause 15. Clause 15 and 16, I think it speaks to the oath and the issues, 16 speaks to the issues in relation if a person wants to complain with regard to incapacity, misconduct, and incompetency of the presiding officers. I think that those two also may need to be considered, especially clause 16, which says the complaint must be on an affidavit. The province raised that concern that people may not even be staying close by to places where you could get a commissioner to give effect to the affidavit, as well as understood the legal terms that says you can only complain as mentioned in that clause. There could be difficulties to comply with the stringent processes, whilst the intent of the bill is just to ensure that if you are aggrieved by the conduct of the traditional leader, the process is not simple and easy as it should be to allow you to air the grievance. Clause 17 and 18 may require that it be clarified and strengthened further as well. Clause 23, the legal concern that was raised, relates to repealing something. I think the legal issue or constitutional issue there to be considered, even if the committee gives effect to the request, is that there are certain older legislation and legislation that was assigned to the provinces and is now provincial legislation. So in the instance of having to repeal certain legislation, in that instance, we'll have to consider whether Parliament still has the power to repeal whatever it is that has been recommended should be addressed in that manner. Clause 24.
Can I request for you? I don't have clause 16 in terms of my document. I don't have clause 23. No. Would be a problem because I need to deal with those particular ones. I don't have them. The document provided to me does not have clause 23.
Chairperson, maybe I should just clause 16, as I said, it's the one that deals with incapacity, gross incompetence or misconduct of presiding officers. It sets out a procedure that if you are aggrieved against the presiding officer, what it is that you can do. And as I said, the terms are very technical and legal for purposes of
the intention.
Listen to her. We all don't have. Just listen to her. Continue. Ma'am.
There could have been a challenge, maybe, because as I said, after the initial document that the content advisor had prepared, we then came together as a team, which was instructed in the last meeting, and substantiated on the initial document and made some corrections and additions. So maybe in the printing process, there might have been a mistake to print the old one instead of printing the one that we discussed and had a meeting over as the instructed people.
Just a moment.
Chairperson, I'm a little bit confused.
Can you, if there's an issue that you want to raise, she's about to finish. Can you allow her
she's
to finish?
She's on clause 16. We've got to go to clause 23. I think it's to clause 23. Yeah. So are we going to get a copy of this legal document to understand what she's referring to?
Yes.
Now or
after
the minutes?
After the meeting. But for now, just listen to her. Continue, ma'am.
The concern that was raised in relation to clause 24 was that the name of the bill should perhaps be considered. That is within the mandate of the committee and deliberation to see whether the proposed name fits what the content of the bill seeks to address. As I said, general comments that would be covered generally in terms of the legal principles and the constitution. One was that in relation to fees, the issue of fees, there's a province that indicated that fees that are included must be looked at, and I think the constitutional issue there is to consider that provision against whether it might not make the bill of Section 77. And in terms of the concerns raised about the separation of powers, I think also there, because the constitutional principles allowed the deviation for purposes of enabling customary system to be given effect, and recognition of traditional leadership has been recognized in the constitution, and that the court has found, in fact, that our constitution does not explicitly speak to a rigid separation of powers, but it does require that it be so. And in line with that, if consistency with the construction of the constitutional court's interpretation, as well as the separation of powers principle itself, is considered to give effect to proper amendments, that there is a possibility that can be done. There was also a question about legal pluralism. If this system is given effect to create dual systems, I think also the Constitutional Court jurisprudence does indicate that there is a place for pluralism. However, it must be subjected to the constitutional imperatives and mandates. So the general consent raised about public participation also, which came from the provinces, I think is an issue that has been addressed in terms of Section 72. The committee is aware and knows what public facilitation obligations it must meet, and I believe that has been properly done as well. Regulations prescribed by the minister are normally prescribed at a later stage once the bill is either an enactment into law, and the concerns raised if they are not fully covered in the manner preferred by the committee, that could also be a problem. But it's a normally accepted procedure that many details that may be required are actually stressed out in the regulation. The last point was on the issue about conflicting laws. If there's conflict, what would be the position that must be taken? I think the principle of constitutional supremacy deals with that concern, and should there be any conflict in terms of the laws, then the constitution will have to prevail. Finally, Chairperson, I think, it, as I said, on general issues, the point on the dates that are included in the bill, which did not come from the consent, but the dates would also require changes and consideration. So basically, in conclusion, Chairperson, there is a lot of substance into the proposals that are coming from provinces, and there should be a deliberation and a committee's decision as to how these proposals and consent should be given effect, but they do have substance. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Honourable members, you can comment on the presentation. Honourable Zunda, Honourable Matila.
Chair, I don't think we will do justice to this bill if we are going to negotiate and debate on issues which the people, South Africa, has rejected this bill. You listen to her, you listen to what the provinces have said. In some cases, some provinces, like the Northern Cape, have rejected the people's opinion in public meeting, and they go forth to support this bill. There are some issues that she raised, like 10.2i, 10.1, that needs, she doesn't even think it can be amended. We need clarity on a lot of things, Chair. If I must start asking clarity, Chair, I don't think we will get out of this meeting today. Let me just raise a few of them, Chair. Let me state up front, this bill is totally unconstitutional. If I need clarity, I need clarity on what you said. What is covered about women? What is difficult about 9.4 and 9.5? I need clarity. What clause 10? What make clause 10 unconstitutional? Constitutional, and how? The issue about the livestock chair. 10.1, as I would love her to read it again, 10.2i or something like that. The sanctions that is unconstitutional. And then there's something, Chair, when you, I'm speaking what has happened in a public hearing in the Northern Cape, and what the people have said, and that I think that was the only public hearing in the Northern Cape in Kuruman area. It was not, there was no public hearing in the Mir area where they were supposed to speak to the Bushmen and the Khoi people. There was no public hearing there. So, in short, Chair, the consultation that they had, there was no consultation with the Northern Cape. You can't go and speak to the Kuruman area people and say, you have spoken to the Northern Cape. That's not the Northern Cape. Let me just say this, what has happened. And I read it, Chair. It's from the one of the inputs, it's from the meeting that was held, a public hearing. It says in the Northern Cape, despite these indications that the bill was not accepted by the people of the Northern Cape, apart from the traditional leaders whose comments indicate that they were looking to entrench their powers, the Northern Cape legislation votes yes to the principle of the bill. It is difficult to understand what that means, but if it is a vote in favor of the bill, it contradicts what the committee heard in its public hearings. So, these are, there's a lot of issues, Chair, that we can debate here if you want to debate. We won't be finished even in the next 3 weeks to have this thing. This bill, as I, let me quote the words of the Honorable Minister of Women and Children, this bill can't even be panel beated. It needs to be rewrite if there is ever an opportunity. It needs to be going back to the people on the grassroots level. We need to speak to those people. We must consult with the people and not the community, not the traditional leaders. The traditional leaders will not live under this bill. They will use this bill to that effect to benefit themselves. So we must speak to the people who are going to live under this bill. And it's not fair because it's unconstitutional. So in such a, I'm saying today, it's impossible to amend this bill. This bill is not even amendable. Even the department said it. Even the state laws can come and say it. It's impossible. So all I'm pleading, Chair, is that let us listen to the people of South Africa. Thank you.
Honorable Matida.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I thought what we will do today is to note what the legal team in Parliament is saying to us. While some of the issues raised around the unconstitutionality of this particular bill is to note all that, so that we go back and get fresh mandates from provinces to come and vote in as far as this particular bill is concerned. I don't think we have the capacity to debate this particular bill. In terms of what we have had today, in terms of the submissions we have received, because that is the process we must follow.
in terms of the rules of the, of Parliament. Now we've had all those things. We can't even debate. We can't even say anything about this particular bill. The reality of the matter is, it's correct what the member is saying, that a lot of issues are seriously unconstitutional. But we can't do anything else but go back to provinces to get a mandate to deal with this particular matter. And that's the issue I wanted to propose, that we go that specific route, that we have noted their input, we take their input to our respective provinces, for provinces to give us a final mandate. And that's the point I want to raise, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. May I take this opportunity to thank the advocate for her advice. I think she's done a very good job, and we actually agree with her in virtually every case. I would like to ask you if you had seen a copy of the document that she prepared prior to the meeting, because we would also like to have access to that document. It's a very valid document and should be included in the minutes. And we cannot continue without it, because as committee members, we need to see exactly what she recommends. And I would say, fine, we can stop the meeting here and go back and wait for the minutes and the document that she has prepared. Or copies can be made of it now and we can talk about it. But I think we should have access to the document. You nodded your head, so I presume you are in agreement, because this is not a classified issue. So we should have a hard copy of the document. Then, whether the state law advisor will confirm that the bill in its present form is problematic on criminal issues, legally infringes on many civil rights, is unconstitutional, and returning it to the department for a complete redraft is actually the only way. In other words, there's only one way with this bill. If this bill is redrafted, will it then address all the fundamental issues raised by the provinces that has not been listed in the list here? Because you must read the negotiating mandate of the provinces between the lines that they have raised. That's not actually raised in this document by the department, by the committee or the department. Many of the mandates proposed by some of the provinces change the original mandate of the bill or shift the objective of the bill, such as, and I'm using this as an example, which may not be the best example, but in clause one or the definition to say enhance versus promote by Limpopo, that changes the objective of the bill. So I would like to know from somebody within the parliamentary legal, like Advocate Benny or so, to tell us whether we can withdraw this bill, because we cannot continue with it as it stands at the moment. And we need advice, like my friend, my colleague from Gauteng said. Where are we going with this bill?
Can I cut you short?
I'm done.
Yes. Honourable member, let us not confuse our duty with the duty of the Constitutional Court. Our duty as legislators is to make laws, and it is the responsibility of the Constitutional Court to pronounce on the constitutionality or the unconstitutionality of the law. And we have rules of Parliament that determine how we should process the bill from the start to the end. And before we reach that end, according to the rules, we will not take the proposal that we are making. We have to follow the rules to the letter. Honorable Nsimande.
No, thank you, Chair. I agree with what you are saying, Chair, totally. And then secondly, the comments made by Honorable Madila, Chair, that we have, there are nine negotiating mandates received that talk to, and the advocate, and I must also thank the advocate for the work that she presented and the team that assisted her, that worked with her, that those nine mandates, Chair, and the inputs we've received and the submissions makes us to process the bill to whatever conclusion. So which that conclusion might be that the bill, you know, doesn't go through, it goes through, or it changes the form. It is the prerogative of Parliament to do that, so to effect changes, to reject changes, and do all sorts of things with the bill that is within the law. So I think that's the principle that we need to carry as we continue with the bill. So I'm seconding the point here that I think we have received the inputs. And the schedule is that we will have to receive the final mandate to the bill. That process stays as is. These processes, these sessions that we are having, are assisting to the finality of the bill, which is what we are about, to get to the finality of the bill, without predetermining what the finality of the bill is. So I'm suggesting, Chair, that I think at this point, certainly I know my province, the mandate I have, Chair, is that they propose certain changes and they've touched on some of them and they are covered. And so in my view, I've got to go back to the province and say, we have received this further on our further engagements. This is what we've received, what we've heard, what are you saying on it? The final mandate is due. The C list, once agreed upon, here's the C list, and the province takes its own dimmed view and gives the final mandate to it. I think it would be fair on my part as from that province. I think what we've raised in the negotiating mandate has been reflected upon by the advocate. Thanks, Chair.
From Jack.
Honourable Chair, I'm worried about this bill, that there's such a big difference between the different provinces. And I don't know if it's cultural or what it is, but we are a rainbow nation. We've got nine provinces and we are speaking how many languages. So I'm going to plead that we don't force it through and put it through. In my province, it will not have any influence. We have no traditional leaders here. So I'm asking that we try to refer it back and to find a way to meet each other. I believe that it's not that it's done. We must find a way that we can build our nation.
What is that going to do on that? And I'm not sure you're the last one.
No, Chair, can I just explain that, you see, I'm from Gauteng. Gauteng does not have, it only has two traditional leaders. And that is in the Hammerskraal area.
Honorable.
Now, the point I'm trying to raise.
Honorable Matila, can I cut you short?
No.
Can I cut you short?
No, I want to raise a point.
No, can I cut you short as the chairperson of the session? Honorable members, we had the presentation from the legal advice because members are now raising the issues that are not going to assist us in the way forward. That presentation has to be taken back to the provinces to check as to whether the issues that they raised in their negotiating mandates has been responded to. And then they will furnish us with their final mandates. The issues that members are raising now are not going to assist. And I think it will be in the interest of the concluding of this meeting without any issues that are not related to the matter that we're dealing with, to adjourn the meeting, that we have received the presentation from the legal parliamentary legal advisor, and we will send those presentations to the provinces for the provinces to reflect on and await the final mandates from the provinces. On that note, the meeting is adjourned. The meeting is adjourned.
But Chairperson, I wanted to raise one issue. The issue is that in townships, we have something reflecting as traditional courts. And therefore, it is important that in Soweto, in Mamelodi, you have that type of situation. Now we must deal with that particular situation, Chairperson.
Oh, okay.